Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Soulful, the podcast that reveals everything you ever wanted to know about sneakers, hosted by me, Jason Coles, and the legendary Mr. Kish Cash. Kish, how are you doing? What's new?
Yeah, I'm all good, mate. I'm all good. More boxes of trainers coming through the door. It's an unrelenting but very welcome problem, shall we say, or issue. It was a problem, a strong, maybe not a problem. But anyway,
I wouldn't be complaining.
That's the current state of affairs. I wish you was the same size as me, mate, because I could break you off some. Do you know what I mean?
No, I know. I know. I wish myself, you know, looking at that collection, yeah, there's a few that I'd quite like to get my feet into. But so who have we got on the show today, Kish?
Yo, we have got this amazing, incredible, passionate, diligent, you know, resourceful, tenacious documentary maker, Yemi Bamiro. And he entertained, you know, both of us during, you know, for what is it, a period of like an hour and a half that his documentary, One Man and His Shoe, is all about, and exploring the whole phenomenon of Michael Jordan, warts and all.
Yeah. And one of our favorite topics.
Yes. Yeah, we got form for that, that's for sure. But yeah, no, the way that Yemi has approached this subject from a completely different angle, and the lengths that he went to get it to make it happen, basically, absolutely phenomenal. And I think it's just only right that we just get to grips, you know, with the background to what the making of the film, basically, you know,
exactly
of, you know, what happened.
Yeah, well, you know, in some ways, today's episode is kind of a follow up to our season one episode that we did with Jordan Geller. The legendary Nike fan, you know, who's got just, well, one of the world's best collections of Jordans.
Phenomenal. Yeah.
But, you know, it's almost impossible to overstate, you know, the impact that this union between Jordan and Nike had. And that's what One Man in His Shoes does so well. And, you know, it was a real work of passion for Yemi, which I hope is going to come across today when we talk to him, because, you know, the impact that it had on not just sport but on culture in general. It was almost like, you know, it was kind of the pivot point of, you know, the second act of sneaker culture in many ways.
Yes.
And Yemi's film has captured that just like nothing else before it, because, you know, while The Last Dance, and, you know, a lot of the Jordan fans out there will have seen that, covered a lot of the Jordan territory.
But that was from a player perspective, his player achievement.
That's it.
You know, the
exactly.
drive to make that happen, and what was the story behind getting to those lofty heights that he achieved with his teammates.
You know, exactly.
Is you know, Yemi going in? Okay, that's great, but there's a whole other aspect to this story that that sort of, you know, we've got to check out. We've got to explore.
Absolutely. So look, without much further ado, let's bring him in, Mr. Yemi Bamiro. Yemi, welcome to the show. Kish and I had a lot of fun when you asked us to talk about the film when you had the premiere back at the BFI. So we thought, you know, we're going to have to ask him to return the favour. So, you know, we are really made up that you could spend some time with us today. To kick things off, for the listeners, can you just give us a bit of a snapshot of what One Man in His Shoe is all about? And what was it that first brought you to the story?
Oh, no. Thanks for having me, guys. Yeah, no, October was really fun. It was, like, awesome to sort of hang out. And it seems like a lifetime ago now. But it's good to sort of, like, reconnect with you. But in relation to One Man in His Shoes, so it's sort of like, you know, it's about the phenomenon of Air Jordan, you know, sneakers. It's sort of like an origin story about, you know, Nike's relationship with Michael Jordan and how that came about, and then also, you know, how that relationship, you know, sort of like changed the world in terms of like marketing, the way in which we consume products. And yeah, so it's sort of like this American history story, if you will, about global conglomerates and sort of like celebrity culture and what happens when all of that comes together. And I think you could look at everything we have in the world now, but I think you can trace that blueprint back to what Nike and Michael Jordan's relationship eventually became. So, yeah, it's a social history story basically about America and politics and race and money and celebrity culture and sports.
I remember when we've spoken about it in the past, you know, it sounded like the film was a real labor of love for you, wasn't it? You know, it took a while to put together.
Yeah.
Were you a big Jordan fan already? What was it that kind of like, you know, lit the fire for you to want to do this?
Okay, so my background is TV. So I kind of worked in TV ever since I graduated from university. And I'd always wanted to make a feature-length film, but I knew that no one was going to come along and give me a pot of money and say, you know, go off and make your feature-length film about whatever you want to make it on. So when I was thinking about ideas for a feature, I knew that they had to be ideas that I was naturally fascinated with and interested in, because I knew that the whole process of making a film independently in the way that we made it would take a long time. So it would have to be an idea that I could live with for a long time. So I kind of feel, not sneaker culture, but the first iteration of this film was basically about Air Jordan collectors. That was the spark.
And you was an Air Jordan collector as well yourself?
No, not really. I was interested in people that collected Jordans because I was sort of like fascinated with their enthusiasm. I was fascinated with their passion. And I'd never seen a film that documented collectors that was specific to that one brand. Like, I'd seen lots of sort of like quite seminal like documentaries about people that collect trainers, and I'd never seen anything specific to Air Jordan. That's where the initial idea for the film started. So I actually started to make that film. I started to sort of like go around the world and talk to Air Jordan collectors. And then I kind of like realized that perhaps I needed the story needed more. There wasn't enough in it, you know. The film needed
You wanted to add more texture to the story.
Yeah,
you wanted to go deeper in.
Exactly.
You
know what I mean? It needed more of a spine. So then that's when I started to think about, okay, well, what about the origin story? Like, why are they drawn to this brand? Well, they're drawn to this brand because of this man. Okay, so who is this man? And then, you know, you sort of like peel the layers back, and then, you know, there's this amazing origin story that tells you so much more about, you know, beyond collectors. It tells you sort of like, you know, about America. It tells you about race. It tells you about economics. It tells you about sort of like all of these really fascinating, rich topics. So that's basically where it started.
That's mad. So the thing is, right, one thing I never asked you way back in October is, what were you wearing when you was doing all this then? What was on your feet?
What was you dipped in, man? I would all, so like when you shoot, you've always got to have comfortable shoes or trainers or whatever. So like, I would never wear, I just thought it was a bit corny turning up to people's houses or like workplaces, like wearing Jordans. I just didn't do that. I think I was wearing the Air Force One sneaker boot because it's durable and it's like really comfortable. Do you know what I mean? And it's like all conditions. Yeah. And I think I wore that a lot.
Yeah, because you was going in disparate climates, weren't you? Really?
Over the years, we went everywhere. Exactly.
That's the thing. Over the years, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how long was this process? It wasn't just done in like 6 months, was it?
No. I had the idea at the end of 2012, November 2012. And then I kind of put together a 3-year plan of how I would make the film. So I said to myself, in 2013, I would sort of like try and make some sort of like trailer, teaser, you know, something that would entice people to give us money. And then 2014, I would try and find the money. And then 2015, I would make the film. And that was my 3-year goal. And it was out by about 5 years.
Well, it's great that you got out. I mean, the thing is,
exactly.
your tenacity, your endeavors, and your passion.
Yeah, but like, I think after 3 years, we were so deep in, it's like we couldn't not do it anymore. So it's like, oh man, we're committed to this now. So we've got to keep going.
Yeah.
That's it. What did the people that you were interviewing think of you? You know, they're looking at you, some British dude. It's like, were they like going, why is this British dude who's wearing Air Force Ones, and they're not bad, but they're not Jordans, interview, you know, what's going on? What was their whole, you know, take on you?
Yeah, I think they thought I was a bit mad. So the first couple of shoots, we couldn't afford to have a crew. So it would literally be me. So I'd just turn up you know, with my camera, tripod, all of my sound equipment, and I would just do the interviews. So I think at first they were like, yeah, this is a joke. Like, I'm, you know, he's a nice guy, but I'm never going to see this. Do you know what I mean? And I know there was a little bit of that. But I think there's always been an enthusiasm from me about this project. Do you know what I mean? Because, and I never necessarily looked at it as work. I just thought, like, you know, this is a topic I'm really interested in. And now I'm getting a chance to go and talk to these people that made a significant contribution to this thing. And so, a lot of the time I was just quite giddy. And I think my enthusiasm sort of like came across, and I think they sort of like responded to that, you know? So that I think the first interview that I ever did, like proper one, was Roland Lazenby, who wrote, who's Michael Jordan's biographer. I went to Virginia to do him, and we basically did it in a Marriott conference room. And I really love that book. You know, it's an incredible book in terms of like, it's a definitive text about Michael Jordan. Do you know what I mean? You don't need to look beyond that. If you want to basically know everything, just go and read that book. And yeah, I read that book maybe like twice before I went to speak to him. So I knew it inside out. And I was just interested in, you know, also the people that he'd spoken to write that book for research. Do you know what I mean? So I think there was just this, it basically became, you know, me just kind of like geeking out with these other people who were really invested in this thing anyway, because they might have written books about it, or they sort of like were part of it. Like, this was part of their orbit for a long time. And so there was just this mutual respect for information and sort of like enthusiasm, I think. So,
I mean, do you know, that was one of the things that really impressed me about the film Yemi. It was just that the people that you got access to, you know, so you had people like Peter Moore, who, you know, designed the shoe, the Jordan 1. You had David Falk, who was his manager. You had Julie Strasser, who wrote, probably for me, you know, Swoosh, the definitive book on. I mean, one of the most interesting people I thought was Sonny Vaccaro, because he doesn't tend to talk too much. Yeah, you know, he's the guy who arguably, you know, first spotted Jordan. I mean, tell us a bit more about, you know, what was his role in the Jordan story? What was it like meeting him?
Oh, Sonny, man, it's such a weird sort of story, because, okay, I knew that we couldn't make this film without Sonny Vaccaro. Do you know what I mean? It's just because if you know this story, then you know the role that Sonny Vaccaro sort of like played in terms of telling Nike that, you know, Michael Jordan was the guy to basically bet the farm on, in terms of like, if you're looking at an endorsement deal for a basketball player to launch your new sort of like basketball division, well, it's got to be Michael Jordan. And he was sort of like instrumental in those sort of conversations and those decisions. So I knew that there was no way that we could make this film without him, right? So after I did the interview with Roland Lazenby, who's Michael Jordan's biographer, he, you know, Sonny Vaccaro is featured in that book, and Roland's sort of like friendly with him. So he, like, Roland did the intro for me, right? So I got an email and a phone number. So I call up Sonny Vaccaro, and this was 2016. And I said, Sonny, like, been talking to Roland? And he's like, yeah, this it's fine. Like, this is great. It sounds like a great project. He was like, I've got ESPN here now. It's just like, why don't you come? He was like, come. He's like, let's set something up for like a month or two. And I was just like, this is insane. This is like too easy, right? Yeah. The conversation was all of 10 minutes. It was really nice. And then about an hour later, he called me back saying, oh, like, he's got some family issues and we're going to have to reschedule the whole thing. And I was like, okay, when can we reschedule it? And he was just like, I'll let you know. Like, I've just got to sort all this stuff out. So I was like, damn. And then little did I know that that process would go on for 2 years. It took 2 years to get Sonny involved, because I think partly he wasn't ready to talk. And I think that, you know, he probably gets hit up a lot of times to do interviews and stuff. And the ESPN thing, he had a 30 for 30, soul man, you know, he's got his own 30 for 30. Yeah. So maybe he was thinking about that as well. But it basically took ages. And then I was in America shooting on a job completely separate to this one. And I just thought, I'm just going to call him up. And I sent them an email and said, I'm in America. And I've been going back in 6 months increments, just asking him if I could film him. And he wasn't ready. And he was like, oh, like, yeah, maybe we can like set this up. And then like his wife, a lady called Pam, who's like just so lovely. She was like, I know you've been trying to do this for a while. I think it had been like 18 months at that time. And she's like, I think we can make it work this time. And then, yeah, they were like, can you get to Palm Springs? So I went to Palm Springs and I interviewed him and he was just like so lovely. And that was the first time I interviewed him. And I interviewed him again in 2019. I kind of wanted to reshoot his interview because over the course of making the film, I just had some sort of like, I had better insights and I kind of wanted to ask him some follow-up questions. So then I went back to Palm Springs with a crew, just with a DP. And then I did another interview with him and he was just such a lovely man. And like, since then, like, you know, him and Pam have sent really like nice emails about the film. They've seen the film. They really love the film. He's a hero, man. I kind of feel that the whole Nike Jordan thing, some people have been written out of history a little bit. And I kind of feel that Sonny kind of like feels that a little bit.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think it was partly because, you know, he ended up going to Adidas, which was probably, you know, for any Nike person, it's, you know, the worst thing you could ever do.
That's like when Sol Campbell went from Tottenham to Arsenal.
Pretty much. It's the worst thing you can do. Yeah. That weighs heavy on him. But I think part of him doing it is the fact that we were going to acknowledge him. We're going to acknowledge his contribution. And also, you know, him and Peter are still friends and, you know, he's still friendly with Julie Strasser as well. I think it was just kind of like one of those things is that, you know, if you gain someone's trust, it kind of, you know, all of those people still speak. So it's just kind of like, he's, you know, you can trust him. He's not going to, you know, he's not going to kind of like do anything disparaging or so that's basically how Sonny came together, basically.
Oh, that's brilliant. What other characters within the film that you interviewed really sort of stand out to you and you like that resonated with you for various reasons?
I got stage fright when I met David Stern, bless his soul.
Okay.
Like, because it was just come on, man. Like that's David Stern. That's the NBA commissioner. That's sort of like, you know, if you think about every time you saw the draft, like you saw him.
Yeah.
And it was almost like this mythical figure. So to see this like little guy kind of like, you know, walk into this conference room in New York where we interviewed him was just so surreal. And he was like such a lovely man. Like he gave me his card. He kind of like wanted to know what it was about. Like, you know, and he was just really lovely. We did, you know, his sort of like secretary at the time just said like only one request, just make sure that the location is really close to sort of like his office so he can walk to the location. So we had to find this hotel. And yeah, he just walked in by himself, no airs, no graces, just a lovely man. And yeah, fantastic. I took a picture with him afterwards. And yeah, I was like, it's still really devastating. Like, you know, it's still really surreal that he's not here. It was only like, it was only 6 months after we did the interview when he passed away, you know? So it was just crazy. It was proper crazy. It was, you know. But he was an incredible person to sort of like talk to, like, you know, on camera and then just off camera, you know, like he's a giant. I think if you talk about, you know, Nike's contribution to this thing that we're all talking about and Jordan's contribution, you can't sort of like discredit or sort of like disregard David Stern because, you know, he was arguably one of the greatest marketeers, you know, in sports entertainment. Like the NBA wouldn't be what it is now without David Stern. So, what Jordan did and what, you know, and what the NBA did, we all have David Stern to thank that. So,
Was it the man or was it the shoes? that exploded everything, you know?
It was a bit of both. We know that, man. It's just kind of like, it wouldn't have worked if Jordan was coming off the bench, if Jordan wasn't starting games, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If Jordan wasn't sort of like dragging his team to sort of like playoff finals, it wouldn't work. So it was the man. But then also, I think Nike were just so forward thinking in terms of like their approach to how they were going to do this.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? They knew that the marketing and the packaging of this was so important. like yeah. beyond the product. You know what I mean? The product was
revolutionary,
sell,
wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, of course. Like the product will sell itself because Michael Jordan's doing those things in the shoe. But if we can sort of like package this and sell it to America in a way that is kind of like, you know, that they've never been sold anything before, then, you know, we're going to break new ground here. And that's exactly what they did, you know?
Yeah. Because Jason and I have, we've spoken about what would the world look like if Jordan had actually just signed with Adidas, like he was so adamant that he wanted to, and the Adidas Forum would have been his signature shoe. You know, because I mean, back in those days, you know, in that period, Run DMC and the whole Adidas connection, etc., was exploding sneaker culture in a way. And then obviously Jordan took it to a next level.
Yeah. I don't think it would have resonated as much because of just what I've just said, but then also like you can't kind of like disregard Spike's sort of contribution. Do you know what I mean?
I was just gonna say, I mean,
product in terms of product placement and like you know, his obsession and those ads, you know, I think that sort of like took it to another level, that penetrated pop culture, you know, Mars Blackmon and those ads, and you know, sort of like Do the Right Thing and sort of like She's Gotta Have It, all of those things were just kind of like, you know, it was just perfect synergy in the way that the dots all connected, you know.
Yeah, Kish and I were saying earlier that in some respects, it was his films that, especially outside of the US, that kind of almost introduced Jordans to the world. You know, the first time I think I ever saw them was in Do the Right Thing. You know, you had the brilliant scene with the, you know, the guy in the Celtics shirt, you know. Yeah. And I mean, and that was just genius, you know, with the Celtics being, you know, the enemy, and then, you know, the whole, I mean, one thing that I noticed was actually was that that is Giancarlo Esposito,
yeah,
isn't
it's
it?
Incredible,
yes, that's
it?
Right.
I mean, and he's now gone on to what he was, I think the most recent thing was in the Mandalorian, so, and that's where he started, you know, wearing his Jordans.
Incredible. Unreal.
It's amazing. But one thing about the adverts that really struck me though was the humor.
Exactly,
the humor element, you know, the preposterous you know, nature of, of what, you know, Mars Blackmon is proposing to Michael Jordan, the greatest basketball athlete of the era, you know. And obviously now we consider him to be ever, but you know, at the time it was like, yo, this guy is like unbelievable.
Exactly. They were really funny, do you know what I mean? It's just like, think about how hard it is to get that right, like now, do you know what I mean? Like it hardly ever works, but they were perfect. They got it so right. They were funny. And I think it was, I can't remember who said it in the film. Someone alludes to the fact that, you know, they are perhaps the greatest like sneaker ads that we've ever had. Do you know what I mean?
I agree.
I think he's right.
I would even say one of the greatest adverts we've ever had, regardless of trying to, you know, push it into that bracket, you know.
Jim Riswold said that. Sorry, I forgot. Jim Riswold said that. Yeah, he basically, because he worked at Wieden and Kennedy, and he was sort of like responsible for sort of like, you know, calling up Spike and giving him the gig and sort of like, you know, being the creative on those ads. And yeah, he, you know, he basically says that, you know, they are the greatest, you know, sneaker ads ever. And I'm kind of like, yeah, you're right. Nothing's ever sort of like eclipsed that.
No,
I don't
definitely
think anything,
not.
Anything's come close.
No.
Do you try to get Spike Lee?
We tried. We tried for ages. I was always very sort of, I don't know, like realistic with my expectations when it came to Spike, just because of the fact that this film is sort of like a warts and all story of, you know, this topic. And I think the final third of the film, you know, asks some questions, and it would have been quite difficult for someone like Spike to be included in a film like ours, given his ongoing sort of like relationship with Nike. And, you know, he's got his own Jordan sneaker. So I was always kind of like, we're going to ask and we're going to keep asking. But, you know, I'm not entirely sure. I think a common denominator with our whole film is like the people that were sort of like integral to this no longer work at Nike. Do you know what I mean? So they're able to talk quite freely about, you know, their feelings, about what happened, about, you know, making a contribution to this thing. But if you're an employee at Nike now, then you're not allowed to sort of like participate in sort of like unauthorized documentaries that they have nothing to do with. Do you know what I mean? So in that respect, I kind of like, I knew that it would be a challenge to get Spike on board, but
no, totally.
We did try.
you know, you tried. Were there any other people that you went after that you couldn't get for various different reasons?
No.
Or was everyone pretty down with it?
No. Everybody was sort of, yeah. We had a wish, like, when I told you that I put that plan together in 2013 of kind of like, you know, how I wanted to make the film and who we wanted to be in the film, we got everybody apart from Spike Lee.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, that's pretty good going, though.
And Barack Obama.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess he was always going to be a bit difficult.
Exactly, with actions, yeah.
Chap. You know, there's time for you still to make it up, you know what I mean?
You listen to Soulful Sneaker Stories, a Soho Radio original.
So, I mean, something that you just touched on it really, you know, the difference that Jordan made in terms of branding, you know, especially at that time in the 80s, you know, because it wasn't just with Nike that, you know, he was kind of became the face. You know, he was on the side of cereal packets. He was selling McDonald's, Gatorade. You know, yep. I even saw in the film.
I've got a cereal packet up there. Can you see it?
Yeah, I see it. It's a Wheaties box.
But, I mean, one of the funny ones was that, you know, he was selling hair care products, which, you know, for a guy that either never had much or had none, was pretty hilarious. But, you know, at that time, for an African-American athlete, that was pretty revolutionary, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was incredible. I mean, I think David Falk talks about it quite well in the film is that, you know, they kind of wanted to sell into America. But in order to do that, they had to sort of like associate him with American brands. So I think it was Coca-Cola, McDonald's, Chevrolet, and Nike. I think they were the first four like massive deals. And then after that, it just kind of watered down. It was kind of like a free for all. So at a point, you know, in the 90s, he was the most marketed sort of like athlete in the world. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. In terms of like endorsements. But it was also because, you know, it wouldn't work if he wasn't great. If you look at Messi or Ronaldo now, like those guys are like the marketing money that they get from endorsements is insane. Do you know what I mean? Outside of their basic that, you know, their clubs pay them. And, you know, this works because they are incredible at their jobs. They're the best. So who doesn't want to be associated with greatness? Do you know what I mean? And excellence.
Right. Exactly.
And I think that's basically, you know, what was happening with Jordan. But I think it was so revolutionary because the late 80s, early 90s, America was in this kind of flux. It was about advances. You know, it was about sort of like this awareness of mass consumerism, this awareness of sort of like the economics of selling stuff and buying stuff and product. Do you know what I mean? So that timing was just perfect.
At what point did you discover that Michael Jordan actually became bigger than the sport? You know, he became that pop iconic cultural figure.
I have to be honest. Like when I was a kid and Michael Jordan was in the NBA, I don't remember watching games. I just remember sort of like listening to my uncles or listening to my cousins just like go crazy about how good Jordan was and how good the sort of like the Bulls were and that franchise was like in the 90s, because I was kind of like a teenager and you know, our sport here was football, you know, so I was sort That's of right. like obsessive about football. But I you know, I knew Jordan and the Bulls was just synonymous with excellence. Do you know what I mean? And like, you know, I used to have a Chicago Bulls jacket and I used to see the highlights reel. I think there was a Channel 4 show, an NBA show. Yeah. And I kind of like used to tap into that. So that's when I just knew that he was the greatest. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. In the same way that kind of like kids coming up, you know, maybe like 10 years ago, probably like looked at Tiger Woods and was like, well, he is golf, basically. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Have you ever worn a pair of Jordans? Have you got Jordans? Do you own Jordans?
Yeah, I've got a pair of, I'm obsessed with the sixes.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, the first one that he won the championship in.
Exactly. And I've never owned, I really like the ones, but I don't have a pair. I've never been able to get a pair, but I'm obsessed with the sixes. And because I think just stylistically, aesthetically, they've just always been the ones that I've gravitated to a little bit. And they're just a clean shoe, man. And like you say, it's the first shoe that he won a ring in. So I've always sort of had a soft spot for those. But like, yeah, compared to sort of like some of the collectors that we kind of like profiled in the film, like, no, like, I like sneakers and I've got sort of like somewhat of a collection, but yeah, it's, you know, it's nothing, it pales in comparison to people like you and people, you know, like in the film, basically.
Mm. Yeah. What that guy in the film who had some, what was it, over 1,000 pairs? I mean, yeah, what was it like meeting him and seeing that collection? It must have been crazy.
Yeah. So I filmed Jumpman twice, right? So he lives in Detroit. So the first time I went to his house, he had this basement that was just like insane, and sort of like he shoots all his YouTube videos from there, and it was just like unreal. It was sort of like going to a museum. And then I kind of went back to film him in like 2018, 2019, and he'd moved house because he wanted a bigger basement because his collection had grown. Yeah. In the time that sort of like, you know, the 3 or 4 years that had eclipsed between me filming him the first time and filming him again. So he kind of like got a bigger house and as a result had a bigger basement. And it was like walking, when I walked into the, you know, his new place, it was like walking into a museum, man, because this guy doesn't just have Jordans. He has all of the Team Jordan stuff. He has all of the sort of like the Bulls paraphernalia. He has all of the Wheaties boxes, all of the Gatorade stuff. He has everything. And I said to him, it's just like, I don't know, man. Like, you know, those American museums sort of like, they should hit you up and basically preserve all of this stuff because you've got to be the only person in America that has this. He said that, I think he says it in the documentary, but like Japanese collectors hit him up all the time. Like, you know, offering insane money for like 30-year-old sort of like Wheatie boxes or Gatorades, like that he's never opened, you know, because that stuff is just, you're never buying that again.
That's right.
You're not getting eBay. You're not getting that ever. Exactly. And he has it. But he's a lovely guy. You know, he dedicated his life to that. You know, he sort of like he used to play basketball. He has an affinity to Michael Jordan. They share the same birthday. But like, you know, he's a FedEx driver. He doesn't have any relationship with Brand Jordan. They don't give him stuff. He bought all of that stuff himself and just collected sort of like built a profile over the internet and does like YouTube videos and has a really massive following and everyone like respects him and loves him. But he's just a lovely guy. Yeah.
The everyday that man passion. Who's just got a passion that's just channeling through. What was his most prized possession that he owned? And what was his favorite pair of Jordans as well?
He's got a pair of, he's got a pair of Jordan 1s from 1985 that he keeps in a box. I think he talks about that in the film. And then his favorite shoe is the Jordan 8. He calls it the Great 8. He's obsessed with that shoe. So he's got every single colorway, of course. I don't know what the most valuable shoe is, but it'd probably be the, you know, the 1985 Jordan 1.
Yeah, the ones that he had in the film were pretty much mint as well. And you don't get too many of those around. So a lot of them have just, you know, crumbled into dust.
Exactly. Yeah.
I've got that issue. I can empathize. I can empathize with that and needing a bigger basement as well.
I think actually Kish, you probably rival that guy, probably maybe not in Jordans, but just in terms of your collection.
Adidas collection's insane. I remember filming you about a decade ago coming to a house.
You've been here, remember? You been here?
So I came when I used to work at MTV and we sort of like filmed in one of the rooms and it was insane.
When you come back, I'm gonna put it out there, when you come back,
Yeah,
it'll be a little bit different. It'll be like when you went back to Jumpman and I was like, oh, hold on a sec, you got a bigger place? Okay. Except for I don't have the bigger place.
Yeah.
It's just, I got more stuff. But anyway, Your film is so fascinating because it just shows you just how one athlete and this marketing machine has just permeated through, you know, beyond. And the fact that your film resonates with so many different people that you may not have envisaged at the time you decided to come up with a concept. You know, you come up, I want to do this. And now it's like, whoa. I mean, are you in awe of, you know, of how it has grown and how you've been received and with the film as well?
No, not at all. I think that there are lots of people that kind of like go and make really good films, and then for what, like independent films, and then for whatever reason don't get seen by anybody. And yeah. I kind of feel that with us, we got super lucky with the timing, because what happened is that The Last Dance came out and resonated with everyone. And then there was this massive sort of like, you know, awareness of Michael Jordan, and almost like an appetite for Michael Jordan. And then our film basically came out into the world. So we existed in the slipstream of The Last Dance. So, you know, I argue that perhaps if there wasn't The Last Dance, or if The Last Dance didn't drop when it did, and it and people didn't respond to it in the way that it did, then our film would have just like come out and there would have been interest, I think. But, you know, people were like, oh, like, do you mind if we call it a companion piece to The Last Dance? And I'm like, no, like, I don't think it's that personally. I think it's, you know, it kind of explores a different part of the story. But I'm like, I'm happy for you to call it a companion piece, because if we can sort of like hang on the coattails of that, then of course, you know, it's a 10 hour sort of like ESPN Netflix giant, of course.
Yeah,
that's right.
See,
that's right.
I disagree. I disagree, Emmy, because I think, you know, obviously The Last Dance was obviously a kind of, I mean, admit slightly one-sided view of Jordan. It was always going to be, it was always meant to be. But, you know, one of the things that you touch on in your documentary, and, you know, didn't shy away from quite bravely, was, you know, obviously some of the darker aspects of not just Jordan fandom, but I guess sneaker culture in general. You know, it's almost that side of things that we don't like to talk about, which is namely, you know, the rampant consumerism. You know, you mentioned people were getting mugged for their Jordans, as you showed in the film. You know, people have been killed. But I mean, I mean, Kish and I debate about it a lot. You know, what can sneaker brands do about it, in a way? Is it even kind of, what do you think? Is it kind of their responsibility, or, you know, what can be done about that?
Yeah, I don't necessarily think it's not black and white, and, you know, no one is responsible for the actions of sort of individuals that kind of like want to kind of like commit those crimes. Of course not. I just kind of feel there is a responsibility, perhaps, if you lean on a community for sort of like trends and sort of like a sensibility. And then when issues happen within that community, you're silent. I think that doesn't seem cool. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
They're setting these trends that are sort of like stretching to other communities and to sort of like other demographics that perhaps would be hard for you to penetrate if it wasn't for this community and this group of people. So if things happen within that community, and then you're not silent, or you're not active in trying to sort of like, you know, denounce those things or sort of like challenge those things, then I think we've got issues. And having spoken to like mothers and parents that have been impacted by these crimes, that's all they ever wanted. They just kind of like wanted some sort of acknowledgement. So no, like, none of them said, like, you know, like, I blame Nike, I blame Michael Jordan. Of course not.
Right.
But I think these are massive corporations. And I think if you're a corporation, then your king is profit. Your king is profit margins. Your king is sort of like dollars and stuff like that. So, you know, it gets blurry when those worlds sort of like collide, and these are horrible things happen, you know? So
That's it. I mean, one thing that Nike has been, you know, we can give props for, and we can really applaud them for, is the way they've championed athletes and have pushed them and supported them. Some of the biggest athletes, not just Jordan, but, you know, Bo Jackson, all the way to Colin Kaepernick, who is basically blackballed by the NFL, and they've taken that up. So in that side, I think one thing you could say is that Nike are doing great things in that regard, but then they could be possibly, you know, activating and showing more concern and consideration to the issues that you've highlighted. That's for sure. But I'm also, you know, thinking, what is the corporate structure like within the corporation? You see, the thing is, how much inclusivity is there? You know, we've got the athletes, brilliant, but how many people are within the company that are actually empathetic towards the, you know, what you're discussing?
100%. No, I think it's a good question. And like I said, I don't know. Like, if you're a Nike employee, then you can't just sort of like, you know, be interviewed. I wasn't aware of that until some of the people that I spoke to, i.e. Peter Moore, i.e., you know, some other people were like, you know, they still have friends. And then they basically told me that that's how it works. And I was like, of course, that makes perfect sense. So I don't know what the internal structures are like there. We reached out to Nike, and, you know, I naively kind of wanted to talk to yeah, I wanted to talk to people still there that were sort of like a part of this, but it just never, it didn't materialize. But I think you make a good point. I think that if you have, you know, people who are at a senior level in a executive or a senior management sort of like level, then, you know, they can sort of like help to implement change in these communities and sort of like come up with ideas and strategies to sort of like eliminate this, because you can eliminate it. Do you know what I mean? It's just like it's kind of mental that this has been happening for like the best part of 35 years. Yeah, it just doesn't have to happen. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah.
What do you make of the whole resurgence in recent years? You know, every time I go down the street, I seem to see, you know, kids wearing Jordan 1s. You know, I mean, do you think that's, you know, part of his legacy? You know, do you think he's still a big enough name that even young people know who he was? I mean, to be honest, I'm not so sure. I don't know if it's a fashion thing or whether it's still because he has that close association with the shoes.
No, I think you're right. It's like, you know, those kids that you're, you know, those kids that you kind of like talk about wearing Jordan 1s, a large portion of them, and this is not for me to be disparaging, might not even know who Jordan is. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think what it is that they're really savvy, because I think a lot of that awareness comes from collaboration. It comes from people like maybe Virgil, who, you know, who sort of like helped to recreate the brand. And I think that's what they're really amazing at. They kind of like continue to sort of like do these deals and sort of like employ collaborators that continue to make them relevant, whether it's Virgil, whether it's Travis Scott, whether it's Drake, whether it's, you know, you can go on. That they're sort of like relationship with pop culture is the thing that keeps them relevant and is the thing that sort of like allows them to sort of like appeal to younger audiences. Jordan was obviously the foundation and will always be the foundation, but as we sort of like move away from that and the decades pass, it's just, you know, marketing people at Nike just being like, okay, well, who are the kids into? And, you know, what talks to the kids and what talks to young people? Well, Travis is incredible. Let's give him a line. And I think that's how it works, you know, and they're just really good at doing it, because you have to identify that, you know, you have to identify it and you sort of like have to come up with a strategy and you sort of like have to execute that. And they kill it every single time. Do you know what I mean? It's just like the Travis Scott line, like his Jordan line is insane, like in terms of like how hard people go for that. And if you look at the product, like it's pretty cool. Do you know what I mean?
The product's dope. The product looks doper than the Drake one.
I think so.
Drake was first out the gate, wasn't he? Jordan collabs. And, you know, no disrespect, premium materials look really fantastic. But yeah, the whole marketing machine, the whole Travis Scott thing aligning is fantastic.
Incredible. Yeah.
You know, incredible. Yeah. And the whole Virgil connection as well.
Yeah.
The rework and the restructuring, deconstruction of the Jordan 1.
Yeah.
That really did propel it to newer heights, you could argue. Excuse the pun when you're talking about Michael Jordan.
I think that's the answer. It's just that they are just incredible at reinventing themselves and sort of like making themselves relevant time and time again. And I think that's, you know, that's why their competitors will never catch up, because it just feels like they were sort of like light years ahead in the 90s. Do you know what I mean? So like, it's kind of, it's taken these brands and their competitors so long to close that gap. And you can argue that Adidas have sort of, you know, got there a little bit, but Nike is still like light years ahead, you know?
Yeah.
It's still the brand that, well, for all kinds of reasons, young people still gravitate to.
So
Yemi, we have to ask you, because this question causes endless debate. It's caused debate between myself and Kish even. Where do you stand? I mean, I think I know the answer, but where do you stand on the GOAT question? Is MJ the greatest basketball player of all time?
Yes. Categorically, yes. I think that was one of the great things about The Last Dance, is because it was a nostalgia trip, wasn't it? It was kind of like, well, yeah, like people just kind of like automatically say Michael Jordan's the greatest basketball player ever. But then I think over 10 hours, that series told you why he's the greatest. You know, it's not just individual brilliance. It's kind of like motivating your teammates and pulling them through, and like not necessarily, you know, having the players or the teammates that are that gifted or that way inclined, but like making them champions and making them winners time and time and again, you know, outside of individual brilliance, like the ability to motivate a team of players that are perhaps on paper and not even on paper, like on the court, just like maybe average, you know, or just above average, but you know, kind of like propelling them and motivating them to sort of like up their game every time and up in their games at the most important moments is just like crazy. That is crazy to me. Like, so that, like he was the captain of that ship every single time.
He led by example, didn't he? Led by example. And it's like, this is, I expect this from you because I'm giving this.
Exactly.
If I'm giving this, you've got to give your all as well.
He just wanted to win. He just wanted to win. And I think it's something that's innate with all sort of like great sports people. People say, oh, like, you know, they're this, they're that, you know, they're not very nice. But I think you have to be wired in a really specific way to have an obsession like that, to sort of like go on those runs. Do you know what I mean? To sort of like to keep winning, to stay at the top of your game. And like he did that. And, you know, I think that there are people that are close. I think, you know, like Steph is incredible. I think LeBron obviously is unreal. But I think that the consistency of MJ and I think, you know, the fact that he has all of those rings and all of those shooting titles and sort of like the dunk contests, all of this stuff just kind of like for me culminates in him just being the greatest. For me,
see, I'm going to be controversial.
That's fine.
Because see, and I mean, you mentioned it there. For me, one of the things that The Last Dance highlighted was one of the real kind of chinks in the whole argument. And I think, especially after the events of last year with George Floyd, Black Lives Matter. One thing with Jordan, which for me was a big problem, was that he never used his platform to stand up, you know, for social justice. And when you go back and you look at his predecessors, so you've got a whole generation of athletes, Tommy Smith, Arthur Ashe, and of course, you know, Muhammad Ali. You know, part of the reason for a lot of people that Muhammad Ali is the greatest of all time is because as much as what he did outside of the ring. And Jordan was arguably, he wasn't the first of that kind of generation who he dropped that baton. Because I think you kind of touch on it in the film. It was probably O.J. Simpson who kind of followed the shut up and play thing. Arguably, you know, people have said to me, well, that was just because, as you've just said, it was because Jordan was so focused on the game. But see, I don't know. It's just the one thing that I can't forgive.
Do you know what? I agree with you. I agree with you. And I think you're right. I think that how long ago did he stop playing basketball? And we're talking about his legacy. And that's the thing. That's the thing that we talk about. That's the chink in the armor. And I think LeBron, I think he recognized that because he's the closest one, in my opinion. Do you know what I mean? He's the closest one. If we're having this GOAT conversation, it's MJ and then it's LeBron. He's the closest one to MJ to sort of like be put in that category. You know, the history books and sort of like discussions in barbershops or on Zoom calls 10 years from now when LeBron's retired, I think that's what they're going to say. He had a school. He always spoke out on social justice. He always took a stand on stuff. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. He won rings. He was incredible. He played, you know, well into his late 30s or whatever. And I think that's the thing that was going to sort of... So I appreciate your point. I think it's really valid.
Yeah, I just think the definition... especially of late has changed.
Yeah,
you know, think now the way that you look at an athlete has to be different, especially an African-American athlete. You know, that using that platform now, you know, what you do outside of the court is so important now. So on court, no one can touch MJ. Arguably Kareem, you know, their records are about equal, but you still have to edge it towards MJ.
Well, it's just the way that MJ played and the era that he played in, of the exactly. double team, the triple team.
Yeah. Yeah.
LeBron isn't getting double team and triple teams, and nor was Kobe really in the later part of his career. The game changed, you know, the way it was played. So it's also that comes into play on how to quantify it. But one thing that really is as well is the crimes against fashion that Jordan continues to commit, because he's just the worst dresser. I mean, you know.
But I think that's that billionaire swag, that you're just kind of like, I'm a billionaire, so it doesn't matter. Like, it's just like the less. Yeah, let's just whatever.
Yeah.
Let's put these oversized trousers on.
That's exactly. That's it. Yeah, so sadly, we've got to wrap it up there.
Yeah, no,
but look, before you go, so where can we see the film? Where can everyone go and watch it?
So the film is on BBC iPlayer. I think it's a permanent fixture there for a while.
Oh, fantastic.
And our international listeners?
International listeners, it's on iTunes. You can go to the iTunes store and rent it and sort of download it there. Yeah, those are the places you can find it.
Brilliant.
Your social handles?
I'm so bad at this stuff. My website's yemibamero.com, and that's got all like my socials on. So yeah, brilliant. That's easy. Just myname.com.
Fantastic.
Fantastic. Excellent. Oh, thank you so much, Yemi.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on. And listeners, we definitely encourage you to go and watch it. It's a fantastic film.
It's essential.
No, thank you, guys.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And thanks for everything that you did in October, all the Q&As. It just feels, that time feels so special given where we all are now and given what the last like 6 to 8 months has been like in terms of like lockdown. Like, we just had that window when the film came out theatrically and we could sort of like kind of be around one another in you know, socially distanced. Thank you so much for doing
pleasure,
that.
Absolute pleasure. Nice. Take care, Yemi.
Yeah, big ups, Yemi.
Take care. Bye.
Jace, wow. Yemi went in. He really went in, you know. But the one remarkable fact that I wasn't aware of, he's already been around my gaff. He's already been around this house and filmed me.
I thought that was hilarious that you actually forgotten about it. But God, sounds like it was donkeys years ago. But yeah.
You know what I mean? But, you know, I mean, I'm still like, you know, I'm just in awe of the dude, because, you know, his diligence and his enthusiasm, it just, you know, hopefully it permeated through to the listeners. You know, he's a generous guy. He's a wonderful guy. He's very passionate about what he does. I can't wait to see, you know, to see and hear about what he's going to be doing next, actually. You know, that'll be a fascinating one, because I'm thinking it'll be essential viewing.
Yeah, I mean, Yemi is one to watch, everyone. So, yeah, definitely. If you haven't seen One Man in His Shoes already, definitely watch it and look out for, you know, his future productions, which, yeah, he's told us a little about. We're not allowed to tell you, but yeah, watch this space.
No, definitely, definitely. And that's it for another episode. So thanks very much for listening. And remember to send your questions to us on Twitter or Instagram at soulful_podcast. And you can also follow myself, Kish, at KishCash1 on Instagram, and also Clubhouse if you're on that app as well. And Jason, he's at Made by Jace. You know what I mean? And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And if you like it, please do leave us a review and tell a friend to tell a friend. See you next time.